Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum, from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker of the Week, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Benjamin Wittes, also of the Brookings Institution and the editor of Lawfare. Welcome, one and all. Since we discussed the possible topics for this week, there's been news. We've seen the Congress authorize a new federal holiday for Juneteenth. We've seen a number of Supreme Court cases. We've seen Mitch McConnell say that he would not hold a hearing for a Supreme Court nominee if a vacancy happens in 2024 and the Republicans take control, or possibly even not even in 2023. But all of that is just going to have to wait for another program, because today we are scheduled to discuss the revelations about the Trump White House's attempts to pressure the Department of Justice on a number of fronts, both regarding the election and challenging the election, and also with leak investigations that may have pulled in, multiple journalists, congressional Democrats, and even Don McGahn, the president's own counsel. So I'd like to begin with you, Ben Wittes. And by the way, if any listeners are not listening to the fantastic podcast about the French Village that Ben Wittes does with our colleague Sarah Longwell, you're missing out. So I would recommend that.
Thank you.
But in the here and now, Ben, what do you make of this? Of these stories, you know, that the Trump administration, for example, was sicking the FBI on their own White House counsel?
Well, so the stories are quite different from one another, though they do have this question in common, which is, you know, to what extent were we seeing political abuse of the Justice Department? Some of them alarm me less than others. So in descending order of alarmometer, I think the single most troubling of them is the pressure that was put on the then Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, to intervene or find in the waning days of the Trump administration to get involved in propagating the big lie and take seriously these entirely non-serious allegations of voter fraud. The story is not surprising, but if you particularly combine it with the other things that we know that the president was doing in this period, which of course culminate in January 6th, this was a sustained effort to get the Justice Department to effectively lie in court and represent efforts to overturn the election results. And, you know, that is the deepest possible corruption of the department. And the only mitigation of it is that Rosen, to his credit, seems to have wanted nothing to do with it. So I think that story is, you know, very troubling. And, and reflects the you know, the some of the worst political abuses of the department since Watergate, frankly. The leak investigations are a somewhat different story because, in fact, there's really no indication that this was unlawful or, you know, the Justice Department does have the authority to investigate leaks, even when they come from Congress and even when they come, you know, when they inconvenience or burden the press. I think the evidence is that the Justice Department was extremely aggressive in with respect to the press inquiries. It's less obvious that that's right with respect to the members of Congress and their staffs for reasons I can explain. The number of these cases involving members of the press is really large, and so I think there's a disturbing possibility that they really just ignored the traditional reasons for caution in this area that administrations of both parties have respected. The McGahn story is very odd and falls in the same category as the congressional stuff, which is they're entitled to investigate leaks. It's very strange to concurrently rely on and investigate, you know, rely on for legal advice and all sorts of things, somebody who you are also fishing for their, you know, phone records for. So I think it's a mixed bag. The broad story from my point of view is that the department was very aggressive about looking perhaps legally for misconduct by people who the president happened to hate anyway.
Yeah. Damon Linker, there was a lower ranking guy at the Justice Department in those final days, Jeffrey Bossert Clark, who was apparently an eager Trump acolyte who was ready and willing to pursue these completely fictitious voter fraud cases. And there was apparently even talk about Trump firing Rosen, I guess, who was the acting attorney general at that point, and putting this guy in. And this was only averted by the threat of mass resignations at the Department of Justice. But this is the sort of thing that really makes, you know, those of us who worry about the fate of democracy and the fate of self-government, it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. Because, this time the people at the Justice Department resisted, but would they next time?
Yeah, I mean, in our long and on this podcast, and then going further among commentators on politics for the last 5 years, there's been a long, ongoing, in-depth debate about what is the threat that Trump poses to our system, and beyond Trump, the entire tendency of politics that he represents. And you know, we talk about, is it the corruption? Is it the low standards for competence? Is it the vulgarity? Is it the cruelty? And I think really I've come to the conclusion that by far the biggest threat is this kind of ethic that he's injected into our politics that is summarized quite well by his own little statement, he fights. That came to circulate around him during the 2016 primaries on the GOP side, that the reason why we should support him versus any of these other 16 people who are running is that Trump alone would fight to effectively the death to win. And this appealed to a lot of Republican voters. And I think what we're seeing now in things like what you rehearsed from the revelations this week about the Justice Department after the last election is this ethic and how incredibly corrosive it is when you have people on one side of our partisan divides deciding that winning is all that matters and the only virtue that should be judged in reference to that end is to fight to make it happen. You don't care about norms, laws, the rules that govern institutions internally. You simply do whatever you need to do to triumph. And the problem with this ethic, of course, is that to fight it relies on a kind of amorphous, more traditional moral virtue on the part of public servants that is fragile, and there's no guarantee that it will persist. And once it's gone, there is really all the norms are gone with it. And of course, it's very easy for the Trump side of this debate to respond and say, look, you people aren't noble public servants upholding the rule of law. You're just a bunch of wimps who wouldn't fight enough to win. And once that kind of an argument gets instantiated on one side of our political divides, it is incredibly dangerous because, as I said, once those who resist it are gone, then there really will be a willingness to do absolutely anything to prevail. And I don't really know what to do about it, but it's really scary as hell.
Linda, I'm going to play MAGA advocate here and say, okay, so they would say, oh, who are you kidding? The Obama White House and administration abused the FBI to pick on Tea Party groups that it didn't like. They wiretapped James Rosen of Fox News. At one point, they even tried to get Fox News removed from the press office. They're going to say that. That's how they play the game. So we're just responding. We're just being defensive.
Well, first of all, as someone who never defended the Obama administration when it did those kinds of things, I feel no compunction to defend the Trump administration when it decided to adopt similar tactics. Look, I think, the worst thing in Trump world and for Trump himself is to be a loser. There is nothing worse than you can say about Donald Trump than that he is a loser. And the fact is that democracy depends less on the goodwill of winners than it does on the goodwill of losers. I mean, the whole system is based on the notion that if you lose, you accept that loss and you go about your business and you come back to fight another day if you choose to do so. And I think that was what is so incredibly corrosive about what Trump has done. Because I think once you take out the prohibitions, the kind of internal check that people have, their willingness to accept loss, then democracy falls apart. I mean, it just simply cannot survive. Then it's really all about who has the most muscle, who can command the most forces. And that, of course, is what autocracies are all about. So it's a very disturbing thing that we've seen. And while I agree that most of the people within the Justice Department decided that they weren't going to go along, I think they sort of placated Trump and Mark Meadows and others by passing on information. They sent it down to U.S. attorneys in various districts as if they should have some reason to look into it. But they basically didn't go along. But there was at least one person in a high-level position holding an assistant AG spot for two different divisions, the civil division and the environmental division. And that was someone named Jeffrey Clark. And he apparently thought that maybe he could become the next attorney general. And if Rosen didn't go along with this, he was certainly willing to do it. And of course, as the Washington Post and other publications pointed out, That didn't happen because everybody ended up in the Oval Office, and the president was informed that it would make this that the kind of resignations at the Justice Department would make the Saturday night massacre look like child's play. So it didn't happen, but it came very close to happening. And, you know, I don't know what kinds of institutional safeguards you can put in place, but we can never get this close to essentially overturning an election.
Bill, there are things going on at local levels. There's the investigation of Trump by the Manhattan DA, and there are other investigations. I don't know what's happening in Georgia, but apparently there was an investigation into Trump's call to Raffensperger demanding 11,870 more votes. Some people are saying that violated the law about not, you know, there's a law against interfering in a federal election. Don't know where those stand, but one of the things that some people on the left are urging is that Merrick Garland has been too soft. He has, for institutional reasons, continued some of the positions of the Trump Justice Department, even regarding that woman, Carol, I can't remember her first name now, who alleged rape. And anyway, but some people are saying, look, Garland should be revisiting the obstruction of justice allegations in the Mueller report and other wrongdoing. What's your reaction to that argument?
Well, unlike Ben Wittes, I am not an expert on the Justice Department or any of its penumbras and emanations. I'm aware of this discussion on the left. I'm starting to get press calls about Merrick Garland's alleged softness. My view, sight unseen, is that he is trying to restore normality to a much abused institution, that he is doing his best not to get into partisan fights, not to try to revisit past issues that have turned out to be explosive. In other words, to try to draw, as much as it is possible to do so, a double line under the recent past, and you know, and then try to begin with a reasonably clean slate. And I don't know whether that's the right thing to do. From an institutional standpoint, it's certainly the right thing to do. From a political standpoint, it's complicated. But I have a great deal of sympathy with the position he finds himself in now. Because if you simply turn the Justice Department around and send it charging off in the opposite direction with equal political zeal, I think that could just make a bad situation worse. I could be argued out of that, but that's where I am now. But let me just pick up for a minute where Linda left off. The question of institutional fixes for a dangerously loose-jointed relationship between the White House and the Justice Department. I think that is exactly the right question to be asking right now. What disturbs me most about the past 5 years is that it is what I at least have learned about the inadequacy of both the Constitution and existing legislation to protect ourselves from a president with autocratic tendencies. And you know, if we simply shrug and say, well, he broke the norms and we have to restore the norms, I think that's missing at least a part of the point. I think this is an institutional problem that requires institutional reform to try to get a handle on it. Details to come.
Might be worth revisiting that book by Bauer and Goldsmith, After Trump, because it was chock full of institutional reforms. So maybe we'll go back and look at that again. Oh, well, Ben, you, Ben Wittes, you had a role in publishing that book, now that I think about it.
I did. I was its editor.
There you go. Okay. Well, if there's anything you'd like to add on that subject real quick, then you can, but otherwise we'll move on to Biden's foreign trip.
So I wanted to address the issue of the criticism that Garland and company have received and suggest that it is A, premature, and to the extent that the issues are fairly joined so far, it's wrong. So on the issues of on the prematureness of it, you know, we don't actually know what issues they have reopened, what issues they have, you know, whether they are taking another look at some of the questions from the Mueller report or that sort of thing. We do know that they're actively pursuing the Giuliani investigation. But, you know, when the Justice Department reopens a matter, it's not necessarily visible. And so the perception that they have been inactive may be just a perception and may have only glancing relation to reality. What we do know is that in the E. Jean Carroll matter, they continued the position that the Trump administration took, which involves an obscure question under the Westfall Act with very important consequences politically. And I just want to say that to everybody who is convinced that, you know, they should be not trying to defend the former president or not suggesting that he's immune from this suit or that the United States can step in for him in this suit, consider how many people have made slanderously false allegations about Joe Biden in the last year or so. And if Biden were to deny those allegations, as Trump denied the rape allegations from E. Jean Carroll, and they were to sue him, would you want Biden to have to defend the suit? Now, I think it's actually a very hard question, and the circumstances in which you I actually don't think the current state of the law is very satisfying. So I don't mean to sound like a sort of executive power hardliner on this, but there was never a chance that the Justice Department would not defend, would not take this position under the Trump administration, under the Biden administration, under the Obama administration, under the Bush administration. And so I think people are, you know, just not thinking the way the Attorney General has to think about what the institutional interests of the presidency and the department are, and the idea that the president should have to personally defend every libel suit that comes up is, it may be right, but it's not a position that the Justice Department is likely to embrace. And so I would say, yeah, there's going to be more institutional continuity between departments, as there always is. If you were looking for somebody who was going to spit in the face of that tradition and for political reasons, and not just partisan political reasons, but, you know, political interests in justice, you know, throw aside the traditions of the department to go after Donald Trump and his people, that person was not Merrick Garland. And those of us who urged the president to name Merrick Garland did that knowing that he would represent the traditions of the Justice Department. And so what I would say is, look, some of it is, you know, you got to wait 2 or 3 years to know how investigations are going to play out. And it is a good thing whenever a Justice Department, whenever a Democratic administration is willing to defend an act of Congress that you know they wouldn't have voted for if they were legislators, or a Republican administration is willing to do that, that is a good thing. And these are the traditions of the department, and we should not be shy about celebrating them.
Excellent points. I cannot help adding, though, that if, God forbid, Tara Reid were to sue Joe Biden for libel because he denied ever having sexually assaulted her, I'm pretty confident that Biden would not respond by saying, "That's ridiculous. She's not my type."
Look, if you turned federal law and tradition upside down every time Donald Trump violated a norm,
that's right.
we would live in, you know, some land described by Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels, and you just can't behave that way. And I am not. I actually think the state of the law on when you can and can't sue president is a little bit messed up. And I, you know, that's a rabbit hole I don't necessarily think you want to go down, though I'm happy to. But my point is that, you know, there is an institution that makes the argument for greater protection for the president in situations like this, and that is the Department of Justice.
Okay. President Biden went to Europe this week, met with the G7, met with NATO, and met with Putin. And honestly, I mean, I'm not gonna deny it. I have to say, watching the way he carried himself, I'll go to you first on this, Bill Galston. I thought, you know, maybe we should always have presidents who are at least 78 years old and have a little experience under their belts. I thought he conducted himself very well. What did you think?
Well, it will not surprise you, Mona, to learn, you know, thanks for the softball, that I very much agree with you. But look, you know, I have to say that, you know, that Putin got Biden about right in his description of him as a balanced and experienced man, and he showed in his overseas trip just how valuable it can be to have decades of experience, not only having these kinds of discussions, but in many cases with these very people, and. So he didn't need a lot of advice from his staff as to what was appropriate and inappropriate. You know, a question that is in diplomacy even more central than the question of what's true and what's false. He knew it instinctively, you know, because he has the muscle memory, not only from all those decades in the Senate, but as representing the United States as the second highest ranking American official in international fora for the 8 years of the Obama administration. So I agree, and I think the lesson is that in many aspects of the presidency, experience does count. It is not a place for on-the-job training. And when OJT is required, it is painful, it is public, it is not helpful. So, yeah, I think the Biden that we saw overseas this past week is the Joe Biden that those of us who voted for him, not grudgingly, but enthusiastically, expected to see. And I'm happy to be able to report that.
Linda, you've worked in White Houses. I was struck that there were a couple of things that they did kind of very professionally and smartly, if you will, vis-a-vis, for example, the meeting with Putin. Now, some people say he shouldn't have met with Putin at all, and you can address that if you like. But they made sure, for example, that Putin would arrive first. Because in the past, Putin has attempted to play a little macho power game with presidents by making them wait for him. So they arranged for him to arrive first. They also agreed that there would be no joint press conference afterwards. Good stage managing, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think it was good stage management. And as somebody who worked in the Reagan White House, as you did, it's sort of a return, again, to normalcy. You know, you had a professional staff that was ensuring that these meetings go off flawlessly, that the President Biden not be upstaged by Vladimir Putin. And I think that decision not to have a joint press conference was really important because, of course, we do remember the last joint appearance by the President of the United States and the President of the Russian Federation, and that was when Donald Trump stood next to Putin and basically said that he believed Putin when Putin said that he had not tried to interfere in the 2016 election. So I think just the, in some ways, almost the, I wouldn't say it was boring, but sort of the banality of it all was very reassuring. It was not as if anything momentous came out of this particular set of meetings. But just as we have emerged from a pandemic in which such meetings could not take place, I think it's important that this meeting took place in a way that was dignified, in which you saw world leaders, not just Putin and Biden, but other world leaders on the stage in the G7 meeting. And I think it was all sort of, you know, a return to what we have come to expect. And also, you know, in the past, it used to be the tradition that that any kind of disputes did not occur in public while president was overseas. And I think in a sense, the Republicans behaved themselves surprisingly by not having some sort of a fuss or a blow up that would attempt to bring to the fore any kind of disagreement. So I thought it was a good week.
Actually, Linda, I'm going to beg to differ with you about that. I don't think the Republicans conducted themselves well at all. But I'm going to pitch this one to Ben Wittes. Lindsey Graham went on Fox and said that Biden was engaged in appeasement. He was joined in this by Ron Johnson, Ted Cruz, John Barrasso, the really sort of head spinning part of where we are in the politics of 2021 is that Putin basically recited right wing talking points when he was making his propaganda pitch after the meeting. You know, he was repeating the kinds of stuff that you hear on Fox News at night, you know, that, the terrible persecution of the peaceful protesters on January 6th and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, there's a few reasons for that. And, you know, you risk sounding like a conspiracy theorist when you articulate them. But the truth of the matter is that the right-wing ecosystem has been serially fed information by Russian intelligence over a somewhat protracted period of time at this point. They recycle matters from each other on a fairly routine basis. And, you know, the one really good place to hear Russian talking points is on Fox News in primetime. And so it's not all that surprising that if you get the Russian president talking, he sounds a bit like a Fox News commentator. And that's the kind of thing that if I heard myself 10 years ago, knew that I was going to say, I would wonder if I had, you know, developed, you know, a delusional system in my 50s. But I do think it's correct. And so the other factor is the domestic Republicans, which, you mentioned some of the ones who have discovered that showing up at a summit with Vladimir Putin can be a scary thing after not really, after not having been bothered much by Helsinki. I guess I don't really know what to say to that, except that, you know, shame is dead and there's no end of human folly. I I have to assume in a way that I don't know to be true, but I do have a residual faith that in the long run, that kind of thing mocks itself. And, you know, voters aren't the most sophisticated actors in the world, but they do remember that you can't go easily anyway, or from being apologists for, you know, Russian activity to, you know, on a dime, criticizing a president for having what's really a relatively dignified meeting with his Russian counterpart. So, look, I don't think it's an accident that those two ecosystems sound alike.
It always reminds me of the American communists, you know, before the Hitler-Stalin Pact. It was, you know, we have to go after the fascists. And after the Hitler-Stalin Pact, the next day, it's like, nope, we those are our friends. Anyway, and then, of course, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, we need a second front. You know the story. Anyway, you better than anybody. All right, so I'm going to turn now to you, Damon. Look, there were certain takeaways from the whole thing. One was that Biden pushed pretty hard to get a united front, both from the G7 nations and from NATO about China. He got more from NATO than from the G7, which isn't surprising because we lead NATO. But, you know, some people might say, well, wait a minute, NATO, that's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Why are they getting involved in matters that, you know, concern our Pacific relationships? And it seems as though NATO is growing and expanding to be sort of the centerpiece of free nations who observe the rule of law and the international rules-based system. In fact, they referred to...
Yeah, they did. I think that, I mean, as in always on foreign policy, I'm more inclined to look at these things through the lens of kind of national interest. And so through that lens, I think there are real limits to how much NATO is going to really be there for us in a confrontation with China. They can act as a good force multiplier for us to an extent, and they certainly helped us for many years in Afghanistan. They were involved and took the lead in a lot of ways in Libya, so that they aren't just limited to kind of the narrowly defined European theater. But by the same token, their interests, the interests of most of NATO other than the United States, is by definition not going to be identical to the United States. We're the ones who have a lot of self-defined interests in East Asia, having to do with Taiwan and many other things, providing security guarantees for places like South Korea and Japan. And so we're on the line against China's rise in a way that the countries of Europe are not, which means that if push comes to shove, they're going to be more inclined to want to defer and say, well, you know, this isn't really our fight. We'll have your back as long as the costs are too high. So for the time being, I think Biden did a great job. He got as much consensus and uniformity as he could get, and that will prove very fruitful going forward. But I do think in the kind of medium term, there are limits to how much NATO is going to be the main force confronting China. If things get hot, it's going to be us, really, in the end. You know, you take as many friends as you can get, and it's great that we're doing a good job to keep our friends a little closer than Trump was inclined to do. He had trouble even distinguishing between friends and enemies and frequently confused them. So it's much better to have a president who actually can prioritize in the right way. So, you know, little victories, right?
Right. I also have to say I was very gratified to see Biden make a point of saying that if Navalny dies in prison, it will not go well for our relations with Russia. And I think he said something like the results would be devastating for Russia. I think that's important, and it's part of who we are as a country. And so,
could I also add along that line, because I don't think anyone else has mentioned it. I think one of the best moments of the Putin meeting had to do with cyber terrorism and the pipeline, and the fact that basically Biden is trying to reestablish deterrence with Putin. Now, the Trump administration's actual actions were not that conciliatory to Putin, but Trump's rhetoric personally was unbelievably conciliatory. And so you had this crazy kind of schizoid foreign policy going on where the president mm-hmm. is talking as if Putin's like our best friend, and his administration itself and the Secretary of Defense are there taking a very different line. We had just now Joe Biden sitting in a room with Vladimir Putin and saying in really no uncertain terms, if you try that crap again by launching a cyber attack on an American pipeline, you're next. So watch it. That is extremely important, and I think might be one of the most important things to come out of this whole week.
It makes you sit up straight and square your shoulders, doesn't it?
Well, it's about time. Like, you know, absolutely. I mean, what else does the president have to do except to make clear where we stand and know that if he's drawing a red line, it's a real red line. Whereas under Trump, we just couldn't do that because he and the administration were speaking a totally different language.
Yeah. And speaking of red lines, Obama wasn't so good at observing them either.
Right. We have a track record of this now.
Okay. Let's take a quick look for our final segment at the mayor's race in New York City. I want to look at this because New York City, big liberal city, basically the Democratic primary is the only one that matters. There is a Republican primary too, but it's a very democratically oriented city, largest city in the country. And yet this race, and I'll go to you first, Linda, this race seems to be coming down to some moderates, or at least that's the way it looks. It's hard. There isn't great polling, but it's certainly from an outsider's point of view, it does seem that this Eric Adams is in a very strong position, and that's important considering that crime is one of the major issues on voters' minds.
Yeah, I found it very heartening that Eric Adams is the front runner, such as it may be. And I guess the person who is sort of hot on his trail is Catherine Garcia, another candidate who is not, totally out of the left wing. She headed up the sanitation department. When you talk about polling, of course, the thing about polling is it may be irrelevant in a race that's going to be decided through, this new kind of cumulative voting.
Ranked choice voting.
Yeah. So it's ranked choice voting, I think, is harder to determine what polls mean. But Eric Adams, I didn't really know much about Eric Adams until last year when he started appearing on television. I think even before he'd announced his candidacy for the mayoral race. But he was, I thought, one of the more really thoughtful commentators on what was going on in various cities and the efforts to defund the police. He is making police reform a central part of his campaign. And there has been this huge uptick in violent crime in New York City, and not just New York City, but other cities around the country. So I think that's hopeful. I guess one of the surprises out of this mayoral race has been that Andrew Yang, who was, of course, a candidate last time around for president for the Democratic nomination, and seemed to be, very well spoken. He became a favorite of the media. he's not doing very well. And so, you know, the fact that you have somebody who has experience leading a big police department, who is thoughtful about police reform, but does not ignore the fact that there is a huge crime wave going on, I think that's good news for the city of New York.
Right. Let me just clarify. Eric Adams did not head the police department.
No, I'm sorry. He was a captain. He was a captain of the police department. Yeah, sorry about that.
But he was the Brooklyn borough president.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Also a former Republican.
Yeah.
So Bill Galston, you think a former Republican can get to be mayor of New York? Oh, wait, Mike Bloomberg.
Well, Mike Bloomberg, let's recall, is a former everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is quite striking. I agree with the cautionary note about the polling, although the most recent poll did do a simulated ranked choice voting experiment. And so that was more interesting than the simple head-to-heads that we'd seen up to now. And Adams bested Garcia in the final round. The progressive wing of the party in New York has been hurt by its failure to coalesce around a single candidate, although that appears to be happening to some extent in the late going. But I think that the broader, deeper interest of the New York City race is as a leading indicator to the actual contours of the crime issue. And it turns out, as it turned out in the late 80s and early 90s, that the communities that are hardest hit by the crime wave, in many cases minority communities, are not interested in less policing. They want better policing. They're not interested in defunding the police. They're interested in retraining the police. And, you know, one woman, I forget which borough she was from, was quoted as saying something to the effect that she was sick and tired of worrying about both the robbers and the police. And that pretty much summed up the view.
I think she said the robbers and the cops, which makes it perfect. Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I think that expresses where the center of gravity of this issue is. And most people in the communities are much less interested in making or scoring ideological points than they are in feeling safe enough to walk out at night if they need to get something at the local grocery store. And I can tell you that that's the way the issue shaped up in the late 80s and early 90s and led to the much abused 1994 crime bill. And I would not be surprised to see history repeat itself, at least politically, with the election of responsible local officials who don't want less policing, they want better policing.
So, Ben Wittes, we have Diane Morales, who's been labeled the most progressive candidate, who wants to cut the New York City Police Department budget in half. She's supported by the Working Families Party, but she's been dogged by allegations of a toxic work environment and trying to penalize members of her staff who wanted to form a union, which is a little ironic. Maya,
at least
Willie,
she didn't want to form be represented by the police union.
Right, there you go. AOC endorsed Maya Wiley. I don't know. We'll see what kind of heft, what kind of power that has. And again, these things are awfully. Oh, there's one other very progressive candidate, and that was Scott Stringer, who was the Manhattan borough president, but he had a Me Too problem and had gotten some endorsements and then lost them, although he still maintains the support of the teachers union, Jerry Nadler, and the climate activist Bill McKibben. But it could be that because of the, first choice, second choice, third choice way that this voting is going, that one of these progressive candidates might wind up being the winner. What's your analysis?
Well, so I, because of the nature of the voting, it's very hard to know what to make of the polls because, for example, Andrew Yang was significantly ahead in all the polls for a while and has now dropped down. But does that mean that he's a lot of people's second choice? Like they kind of liked him, but then they fell in love with somebody else. But a certain large percentage of people would put down Andrew Yang as their second choice in a field this large. The likelihood that nobody gets to 50% is very high. And so, if you're serious about ranked choice voting, one of the consequences of that is that you're also serious about the idea that races particularly like this are going to be very hard to poll, and that you actually have to go through the exercise of waiting to vote till votes are counted, and not just first choice votes, but you tabulate the instant runoffs as well. And I actually think that's good. I think it's good to not know who's going to win a race like this until it happens. It reminds people that, the act of voting actually matters and is not simply a ratification of the acts of pollsters. I do think the structure of a race like this tends to disfavor the progressive candidates, which I wholeheartedly support disfavoring hard progressive candidates. But and the reason is that the left really does have a way of fracturing over minor differences, and so you end up with these candidates that from a moderate point of view are very hard to distinguish from one another, but their factions really do not like one another or support one another. And I also think, as you all have said, that the atmosphere now, both with respect to crime, but also with respect to the larger 6 months of relative success of the Biden administration, which is, not especially moderate in its policy, but extremely moderate in its tone, has, shifted the momentum a little bit away from the AOC wing of the party. And so I would not be surprised, particularly in an environment of ranked choice voting where, which tends to disfavor extremes. If you saw the high watermark of the progressive left, in at least for now, in the Democratic Party, having that we may be past it.
Okay, Damon, I'm going to sketch a somewhat optimistic scenario, and you can then shoot it down if you like, but. If you look at what's happened in the past week, we had Biden having a successful foreign trip. Maybe that doesn't matter that much to American voters when it comes to, the election time. We'll see. But you also had the announcement by Joe Manchin that he's fine with a compromise bill that would contain some of the features of H.R. 1, S.1, the For the People Act, but not others. And this position, and her Manchin's position, was endorsed by Stacey Abrams, who is known for as kind of the poster girl for signing up African American voters in Georgia, and made a huge difference there. And you have talk about a compromise on a possible compromise anyway on an infrastructure bill. It's almost and then if the mayoralty of New York goes to a non-crazy candidate, it might even begin to look like the Democratic Party is finding the sane center-ish.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me hugely, because I've always suspected that the Democratic Party is pretty divided, but the most progressive faction is by no means the dominant one. And I mean, we all know from our experience of living through 16 years of New York politics from the 90s through the 2000s, we had two terms of Rudy Giuliani, Republican, followed by two terms of Mike Bloomberg, semi-Republican. And that, you know, that says a lot. Now, we've had de Blasio, who is very much not that, but he's also leaving not all that popular. So, I mean, I'm heartened to see all of these trends. In the end, I think that my own view is that the Democratic future, if it wants to remain a majority or a strong plurality party in the United States, cannot be to go in the AOC direction. There simply are not enough votes over there, and it's very hard to unite those votes with votes in the center. So I think it's a dead end, and I'm pleased to see it. The only aspect of what you said that I will be a little bit skeptical about is the stuff about Joe Manchin and his moves, which I support in favor of some voting reforms. I'm very pleased to see that Stacey Abrams has come out in support of those. And for about 30 minutes, I was encouraged. But then I saw a statement from Roy Blunt, Republican senator, saying, quote, once Stacey Abrams endorsed Manchin's election compromise, it became the Stacey Abrams proposal.
Oh, which, for God's
which
sake.
Just by, to which I tweeted in response, everything is so stupid. Like this is just our moment encapsulated in a way. Yeah. Like any move toward trying to find some rough and ready compromise in the middle gets undermined by one of the two sides as quickly as possible, and more often than not, the Republicans. So there we have it. But yeah, in general, I'm very encouraged by all of those moves that you listed.
Okay. No good deed goes unpunished, as the saying goes. All right. Let us now turn to our final segment, our highlight or low light of the week. Bill Galston, you first.
Yes, I want to call attention to a piece that just appeared in the New York Times, which made public a very interesting and promising private effort to put together a commission to do what the 9/11 commission did, but apart from the political system. It's no accident that the same guy, Phil Zelikow, who served as the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, is spearheading the formation of this civil society effort, independent of government, backed by a number of major foundations. And I think there's a pretty good argument for trying to do this away from government, because it is not clear to me that under current political circumstances, we could have a searching and impartial pandemic inquiry, even remotely resembling what we saw out of the 9/11 Commission. That was politically fraught, but in the end, politically manageable. I'm not convinced that the politics of a pandemic inquiry authorized and to some extent shaped by the Congress of the United States can achieve that. If the Congress does manage to do something good about this, Mr. Zelikow has pledged his full cooperation. But there is a plan B, which I think is a very good and promising one.
Okay, Linda.
Well, I am going to go with a piece that appeared on June 15th in Commentary Magazine by Noah Rothman. On the online version, and it is entitled "Don't Let the Backlash Against Critical Race Theory Become a Victim of Its Own Success." It's a very smart analysis by Noah Rothman, and what Noah suggests is that even though critical race theory is a very bad idea and has no place in our schools, the effort to basically ban it from public school curriculum is not the best way to combat it. And what he says in sort of summing up is that, you know, you don't want to have one illiberal idea replace another illiberal idea, and that the idea of having various forms of ideology expressly forbidden by state legislatures ends up not really furthering free inquiry, not really furthering the kind of aims that liberal education should in fact be promoting. He said, in the contest of competing illiberalisms, illiberalism wins. So I thought it was a very good piece.
Okay, Ben Wittes.
I, just before we recorded this, I sat down virtually, as one does these days, with four remarkable people to talk about the Biden-Putin summit. One was Alex Vindman. One was Alex's former boss, my colleague and Bill's, Fiona Hill. One was Alina Polyakova of the Center for, I got to look up the name of the organization.
Yeah, we'll get that.
It's SEPA, and it occurs to me one was Alina Polyakova of the Center for European Policy Analysis, and one was the former president of Estonia, Tomas Ilves. It was in front of a live audience that Lawfare convened, and it was just a remarkable conversation from a diverse group of people who are interested in Russia and Eastern Europe from a variety of different perspectives. And they had rather different attitudes about the Putin-Biden summit, but some very interesting common ground as well. And I learned a lot about President Putin and how we should and shouldn't be interacting with him. And so we're going to run this on the Lawfare podcast tomorrow, the audio of this, and I commend it to people. It's an extraordinary group of people talking about a genuinely a peculiar event that happened. And it even involves the funny story of Alex Vindman's first day at work on the National Security Council, which happened to be the day of the Helsinki summit.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, I'll look forward to that. Damon Linker.
Well, to keep with what seems to be kind of an upbeat tone for today's podcast, and also, Mona, your comments before the last question you asked me, kind of glass half full statements, I want to single out a Supreme Court decision that came down just today, Thursday, titled Fulton v. Philadelphia, and I see this decision as a triumph for liberalism, rightly understood, and in two senses. First of all, because it appears in looking at this case, which involved, by the way, a Catholic social services organization that sued Philadelphia after the city excluded it from a foster care program because the organization refused to certify same-sex couples as foster parents for basic Catholic reasons. And what we ended up with in the case was a unanimous decision that Philadelphia had acted wrongly in this case. And I think that's good both because Chief Justice John Roberts was able to put together a unanimous decision, and he did it by making the decision relatively narrow so that everybody could jump on board, including the three liberals. If you read through the decision, you see that there's some evidence that there was the option of a more firmly conservative ruling that Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch would have approved. But probably then it would have been a 63 decision with the liberals dissenting. Instead, we got a narrower decision, but one in which It was unanimous, which I think is good for the court and a good model for how to conduct oneself in a polarized environment. But more importantly, I think it was a triumph. The decision was a triumph for liberalism because it held out a vision of a deeply pluralistic society where people who have firm religious convictions are not protected in their free exercise of religion merely by going to church or praying in their private homes, but by joining with people of common faith in civil society, doing deeds, contributing to the common good as they see fit, and are not required to check their faith as a price of admission to the public square. So I applaud the court for its 9-0 decision affirming this capacious vision of classical liberalism.
And by the way, there are lots of other agencies in Philadelphia that do place with same-sex couples.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Okay. I would like to draw attention to a Substack by Noah Smith. He goes by No Opinion, which is cute. Noopinion.substack.com. It does require payment, but I think it's very well worth it. He's a very bright and interesting writer. And this one in particular that drew my attention was called The Terrific Triviality of Twitter. And even beyond the alliteration, it's a really interesting piece about the outsized influence that Twitter exerts and how it does it. And he's got reflections on, you know, human nature in there. That is, we all are afraid of being criticized. We all are particularly afraid of a mob that, you know, is going to ostracize us. But he talks about how these fears are really illusory, that Twitter only has power. It has a very, very small number of people. And the notion that people are actually being fired because of things they tweeted is ridiculous. So it's sort of a call to arms to put Twitter in its proper place. And I recommend it. And with that, I want to thank Ben Wittes for joining us today. I want to thank all of you for listening. I can be reached through The Bulwark. If you look up my email address there, I'll tell you anyway. It's monacharon@thebulwark.com. Welcome all of your comments. I read them all. I don't always get a chance to respond to each and every one, but do enjoy hearing from our listeners. Get some good ideas. If you're feeling particularly benevolent, please go and rate and review us. Brings new listeners to the podcast. And we will return next week, as every week. Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.